Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of a loving God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been kept sober since January the 12th, 1984, and I'm very grateful. And they've told me everything to do, so I'll try to do it, but they forgot to give me a preamble, and I think I can wing it, but if I miss a word, some of you guys just don't step on me, okay? After 21 years, you'd think I'd remember it perfectly, but hey. You got the wallet card? Would you mind bringing it up? Because I will hate to screw up here in front of 800 people and on a tape and all that stuff. That would just be so embarrassing, and I easily embarrass, you know. Thank you so much. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And again, thank you for that. I've been asked, it says, Dear Chair, it is important to begin and end on schedule. We'll do that. Remind attendees that the special needs seating sections are exclusively for those who are in some way handicapped. And I think we have that set over here. And I'd like for us all to observe a moment of silence, please, in gratitude to the AA recoveries, millions of which have occurred for the last 70 years. Thank you. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that AA speakers and AA members not be photographed, videotaped, or identified by full name on audio tapes and in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our efforts to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. CDs and audio tapes of this meeting will be available at the tape sales booth in Hall E of the Convention Center. In keeping with our traditions of anonymity, tapes will list only names of meetings and not names of speakers. Oh, my chance at fame is gone. And yours too. Oh, well. Okay. Is Mickey F? Yeah, I guess he's not here. He would be up here faunching at the bit, if it were, to be the first speaker. Hey, was the opening ceremony last night great or what? Is this something? When you see that many grown men in tears, you know something special is going on. I loved the bagpipers also. I drank enough of their national beverage to float several battleships. I'm always very enamored of nostalgic about those guys. In any event, my job is not to tell my story, and I assure you I shall not, but to introduce our speakers today, of which we only have two. I've already told them they don't have to be restrained at exactly 20 minutes, and they can go on a little bit. Because we do have the time for the meeting, and I know they'll have wonderful things to say to us. And our first speaker is Ken Kay from Wisconsin. Welcome, Ken.
Good afternoon. Hi, I'm Ken, and Kenny, and I'm an alcoholic. And, yeah, it's really, really good to be here. And, of course, I didn't expect to be the first one. I was like, gee, I'll get to be in the middle and get to hear someone go first, and I don't have to be, you know, the headliner and close the show. Instead, I get to be the opening act, and that's good. That's good. I just need to take a deep breath and to thank God, the General Service Board, and to thank GSO in New York, especially Doug R., to have this opportunity to speak today. Well, more importantly, not to really speak, but to share my story and to hopefully put something out there that'll help people, because I know it's going to help me, because that's how it worked for me when I came into the rooms of AA. And, yeah, someone would have told me 5 years ago when I was at my first national conference, I should say my international conference, in Minneapolis, that I'd be having the opportunity to do this at the next World Conference. I wouldn't have believed it. But then there's a lot of things that I heard when I first came into the rooms of AA that I didn't believe, but they've come true. And that's a wonderful thing, and it's something that I'm very grateful for. So, yeah, my partner, he reminded me, he said, you know, even though you can get up there and be spontaneous usually, it probably wouldn't hurt if you gave yourself a little outline so you could keep it that it's following a thread. So I actually brought some notes with me in an attempt to do that. And it's nice to have someone in my life who can help me and be a part of my life. And that's another gift of the program as well. But, yeah, I wanted to do my – well, it's, you know, when you do something like this, it suggested your experience, strength, and hope, and then also to kind of, you know, have an introduction, have the body, and have the conclusion, and hopefully bring it home. And I'm going to do my best to do that. And I believe with God's help, I'm going to be able to. So I wanted to talk just for a moment about the experience I had last evening before the opening ceremony. And I went out to get a bite to eat, and I came here by myself. There's some other folks that are here from Milwaukee that I did connect with, and we were together at the opening conference last night, the opening session, I should say, and that was really nice. But I'm sitting over at the restaurant by myself. And having lived in cities for many years, you know, I'm not too uncomfortable with that. But, of course, well, you know, in AA, people don't always let you do that. And folks, a gentleman came over to me and asked if I was expecting someone to join me. And I said, well, no. And he said, well, would you like to join us? And you know, initially, of course, it's like, well, and I was like, well, yes. You know, I've learned to say yes. And I went and I sat with these folks, and they were wonderful people. You know, they welcomed me. And they, you know, they accepted me without even knowing me, and that's something that I always wanted. That's what I was looking for all along. And if anybody would have ever told me I was going to find it in AA, you know, it just never would have crossed my mind. And as usual in AA, there's no coincidences because as we started to chat, it turns out that they're from Long Island, and I was born in Brooklyn and raised on Long Island. And then it turns out I mentioned that I had gotten sober in New York City, and they mentioned how they had been in New York City recently, and they had been to this meeting on the Upper West Side in the little room on 96th Street, and that was my home group. Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, talk about no coincidences. And that's a very special room to me, and I'll bring that up a little bit further down in what I want to share this evening. But, yeah, it brought a smile to my face and brought a smile to their face, too. And we traded some stories, you know, but the thing that's nice now in sobriety is that we don't trade war stories. You know, we talked about how we had other coincidences like that happen in our lives. And one that I shared that was special to me is that I'm a little bit of a conference roundup convention junkie. And so, yeah, I like to, you know, I'll tie a vacation into going to a roundup or a conference. That'll become my destination. And one of those that I did recently, and part of me is like, well, I don't know if I want to tell everybody about this one because it's a really nice one, especially if you like to go swimming. It's down in St. John in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and it's called Camp Easy Does It. And, yeah, Camp Easy, I even got the cap from it. What I wanted to share is that when I was there, I also learned about the meetings that happened on the island, and I stayed there longer than the conference happened. And here you are on St. John, which, you know, you can only get there by boat, and they have a meeting on that island every day. And so I go to the meeting, and I get there early because I want to make sure I know where it is, and I'm going to be there on time. And the gentleman comes to open up the church. Because, yeah, it's no different, no matter where you are, probably, that are in the churches or the basements of churches. And we start chatting for a minute, and the gentleman mentions that it's his 19th anniversary, and he had gotten sober at a rehab in Keene, New Hampshire. Well, at the time, I was living in Keene, New Hampshire, and I happened to be the first one at the meeting that night and on this gentleman's 19th anniversary. So to me, it's just another one of the many examples that there are no coincidences. But yeah, to make the segue into my story and to follow with the theme on our primary purpose, I need to put something out there. We just moved, my partner and I, in the last 2 weeks. And we live in a very rural place now in Milton, Wisconsin. And what I need to do is I need to get myself a new sponsor. I need to get connected with a new home group, and I need to get connected with new service. And that's part of, it's been part of, you know, my primary purpose in helping me stay sober. And I've learned in doing so, it helps all of us stay sober. So I need to make that commitment and have that honesty with myself that's something that I need to do. Because it's too easy for me to go around saying, yeah, I'm okay, or yeah, I don't need to come join other people at the table, when those are exactly the things that I do need to do. And I'm able to ask for that help today. So, yeah, if I may, going to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope. My first drunk, which was my first drink, was a quart bottle of Colt 45. And I was in eighth grade. Went over to Vinny Ruggiero. Well, maybe I shouldn't say his last name. I guess it's okay. But went over to Vinny's house. And, you know, Vinny had what I wanted. You know, he was cool. He already was like growing some hair on his face. So I was like, you know, that drew me, and you know, I wanted what he had, and so I got my quart of Colt 45, and I drank it, and I got dizzy, and I got sick as a dog, you know, and I don't recall it, you know, being any fun, but needless to say, I went on and I did it over and over and over until I thought it became fun, and I'm gonna fast forward, even though we do have a little bit of time. And if anybody here knows me, they know that I can talk a little bit if I'm given the time. So I'll definitely watch myself, and I know people will be watching for me. But to fast forward it a little bit to go bring it up to the college days, you know, I'm a baby boomer, and so yeah, I was in college, you know, high school the late 60s, college the early 70s. So of course there were a few things going on besides alcohol, and after I got sober, you know, as first starting to share my story with people, I said, well, I didn't really drink that much in college. I was doing other things. But then after I was sober a little bit longer, I started to remember some of the things that were sitting on the windowsill in my dorm hall, well, they call it the residence hall these days, was gallon bottles of Gallo cream sherry, you know, because I had to have something sweet. And I said, well, maybe I was drinking. And then as I thought about it a little bit harder and got a little bit more sober, I remembered that I used to pour those gallon bottles of Gallo cream sherry into my wine boa, which my aunt had given me for Christmas one year. I said, did she know something? Yeah, maybe she did. So, yeah, that and a number of other things was what I would take in when I was in college. And, yeah, it just... I could say that there were some good times, and actually, I guess there were some good times, because, you know, that's part of youth, that's part of, you know, life opening up, and I really, you know, I love life, you know, as I think most people do, and I wanted to experience it, but what I didn't realize was is that as I continued to indulge and to have the disease, you know, become part of my life, that actually I was shutting myself away from all of that. And so that's why I hesitate today to look back upon it as good times, because I was really going in the direction that I didn't want to go, which is rather ironic. You know, now, here in sobriety, and I'm very thankful for it, I'm able to be going in the direction that I do want to go. And so, yeah, I was one of the fortunate ones that was able to finish. I finished college, and I started working, and I found myself, in New York City. And you know, I had wonderful things happening. I work in a field, I continue to this day, but when I started in New York and my 15 years there, only two of them being sober, you know, I work in an industry where alcohol and other substances are very accepted. So, you know, I had arrived. You know, I mean, it was, I used to get those things for Christmas presents. now. And it's like, yeah, life is good. This is the way it's supposed to be. But to keep fast-forwarding it is that I left New York for a little while, and then I found myself back in New York. And alcohol was starting to not work for me, and the other substances were starting to not work for me. And I actually was able to stop doing the other substances, but I found myself not being able to stop drinking. You know, I found myself doing the same things that I did when I drank that quart of Colt 45 with Vinny. You know, I found myself getting up in the morning, you know, regularly having the dry heaves in the shower. You know, I found myself, you know, puking, you know, after I would do some of the things that I like to do to go along with my drinking, because then that was just part of the ritual. That was part of, you know, once I got past that, then I could just keep going. You know, I love it when I say things like that, and I'm looking out and I see people shaking their head going, yep, yep. You know, so that's one of the nice things about AA as well, is that I'm not alone in those areas either. But yeah, so that's what was happening to me. And what was happening to me is that I was getting up in the morning and getting ready for work, going through those rituals, getting dressed, walking out the door, and I walked to work, and I would find myself at the bar before getting to work. And I would find myself drunk before noon, and I would find myself, you know, just trying to rehearsing, calling into work, saying that I'm not going to be able to make it in today. The same way that I used to have to rehearse for those many years in New York, saying that when I had been up all night, you know, because I couldn't talk. You know, my synapses weren't firing properly, so I couldn't complete a sentence, you know, and that's why I look back upon that and I go, was that really fun? You know, I don't think so. You know, I can make it sound like fun, in reality, it really wasn't fun. Had some good experiences in New York. I mean, it's a wonderful place, but the best thing that happened to me in New York is I got sober. And what happened was is that I was at my office and working late, as usual. I was the only one there. And the phone rings, and I answer it, and it's my friend George. And George and I were running buddies back in college. You know, so we're now, you know, in the early 1990s. So it's been a while since I've spoken to George. And George is living in Australia at the time, and he's calling to say he's going to be coming back to New York City. And he had to track me down a little bit. He had to call the previous company that I worked for, but he found me. And what happened was is that I found myself telling George that I wanted to stop drinking. You know, I don't know why I started telling him this. I mean, I haven't talked to this guy in years. And George, of course, and most people know where I'm going with this, is that George says, well, you know, I've been in the program for 5 years. And when George got to New York, George took me to my first meeting. You know, and, you know, to this day, George is sober, and we stay in touch. And he was there for me in the beginning. But I didn't stop just because I spoke to George, and I didn't stop because it stopped working for me. And, you know, I was doing things like, well, I was blacking out at the end all the time. And to me, that was a normal, acceptable thing to do. And, you know, blacking out in New York City, well, it's not a good idea, I think, to black out anywhere. But blacking out in New York City in particular, when you're walking home, you know, crossing all those streets, I literally would not, of course, have a clue of how I got home, but I got home safely. And I'd wake up in my sleeping loft, and I would have to take the ladder to come down, to get out of the sleeping loft, you know, and I would find things at the bottom of the stairs at times, like broken glass. Once I found a glass broken in half, you know, jammed into the sink, the stopper of the sink. You know, and I thought to myself, well, you know, what would have happened if in a blackout when I went to get water in the sink, because, of course, I was very thirsty after drinking all night, you know, I would have slit my wrist, you know. But none of that happened. But none of that stopped me from drinking either. I was also, during that time, diagnosed with another disease. And in order for them to properly diagnose it, they said, well, you need to stop drinking. You know, and I know how I come in the rooms and heard how people, you know, you would say to yourself even before coming into the rooms, well, if the doctor said I had to stop drinking, I'd stop drinking. Well, I couldn't stop drinking. You know, I actually did, and I believe that was the grace of God. And they did the test, and the doctor, the neurologist, says to me, well, Mr. Koberger, he said, you know, we're still not quite sure what it is, but you can go back to drinking. That's all right, because it has nothing to do with alcohol. And I was like, okay, you know, and I did, because I didn't know at the time. But yeah, I started going to meetings, and I wasn't honest in the beginning. After about a month, I wanted to see what it was like to drink again. Because I'd always also signed myself up to Phoenix House. You know, and again, you talk about no coincidences. I'm living on 73rd Street, and I find out that there's a Phoenix House on 74th Street, the next block up. And I was able to go there like three times a week after work and spend time there with that group, which was a little bit harsher on you than the folks, even the folks in AA in New York. But that was something that I needed. I needed that accountability because I was so slick, I was going to get over on myself. Now, I needed to have somebody, you know, telling me that I needed to go urinate in a cup when I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, but meanwhile, I'm walking to my job on Broadway between 67th and 66th Street. You know, that's a real, you know, I just think of the two extremes there, and it's like, oh, okay. You know, there was a time when that didn't seem odd to me, but now I look back in hindsight and I go, well, you know, there was something going on there where you needed help. And what happened was is that I was able to get honest. And even though I had gone out and started drinking again and went back into the rooms, my home group up on 96th Street, and lied to them, you know, and still continued to count days, after a while it didn't work for me. It just didn't feel right. And I had to get honest. And I did get honest. You know, and I'll never forget the people in that home group, even though it's over 10 years ago, up on 96th Street, because they were just there for me. You know, and there was a little aside here. There was a gentleman, his name's Peter, and he would be there every morning. And Peter at the time, I didn't know why he was able to be there. It was a morning meeting at 8:45. I didn't have to start work till 10 o'clock. And Peter would always be there. And he'd always have something, you know, some words of wisdom for me as I would, you know, be leaving to go off to work. You know, and that would help me through the day. And what happened with him is that he was diagnosed with cancer. And Peter still came to the meetings, and Peter still had those pearls of wisdom. You know, and then Peter couldn't come to the meetings anymore, and we brought a meeting to Peter's house. You know, and then Peter had to go to the hospital, and then we brought a meeting to the hospital and to the intensive care unit. And this was in my first 2 years of sobriety. You know, and this is part of our primary purpose, because I was just becoming a part of it. I didn't know how it was happening or why it was happening, but it was happening. You know, and now I can look back in hindsight, especially having an opportunity like I do today, and it's a pretty amazing thing. And then, of course, Peter passed away, and they had a memorial service for him in Central Park, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people that were there for him, you know, that day. And that sticks vivid in my mind. You know, the same way that at that home group that I went to, which is a meeting that meets 365 days a year, where you get to hear at this beginner's meeting called First Things First, someone share their experience, strength, and hope. And what I heard from those people is that they didn't have to go back out drinking again. Because I heard about people who, you know, lost their partner. I heard about people that lost a child. I heard about people that lost a limb. I heard about people, you know, that lost whatever you can imagine that somebody can lose that's dear to them, and they didn't pick up a drink. And that stuck with me. The other thing that stuck with me is that, and I just lost my train of thought hearing that telephone, but the other thing that stuck with me is that there was a common theme, one thread that was common for everybody that went back out. And what it was is that they stopped going to meetings. You know, and that stuck with me. And so I found it really, really helpful in the beginning, you know, to hear those kind of things, you know, and to hear do 90 meetings in 90 days, which I was able to do because I lived in a place where the meetings were that available to me. You know, and then I found myself after 90 days, I was nominated to chair a meeting. You know, and then I had to go find speakers myself for that meeting, so I had to go out to other meetings. You know, and this was a room where people would wait in line to get into the next meeting, because there was a meeting prior to ours, and the meeting only holds 45 people. You know, and they had a lot of signs up on the wall, you know, things that took, you know, almost 2 years for me to start to understand. Things like, if you always do what you always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten. I mean, I looked at that for over a year, and I was like, yeah, okay, you know. But then one day it was like, oh, okay, now I get it. That means I have to change, you know. And that's a hard thing for this alcoholic to do. You know, it's not easy for me to change at all. But yeah, another thing that happened to me after being sober for a year, I was like, well, gee, you know, why aren't I feeling better? you know, and of course, you know, being an alcoholic, I want to feel better. I want more, you know. And it dawned on me is that I wasn't being honest with myself about the fact that I'm a gay man. I mean, I knew it. You know, I'd been living as a gay man, but I had been living in the closet. And shortly after my first anniversary, no coincidence again, I get an opportunity to speak at my home group up at First Things First. And as I spoke that day, I came out. You know, and nobody threw me out of the room. Nobody told me I couldn't come anymore. You know, people were happy for me. You know, they came up, they put their arms around me, and they thanked me. And some people were like, "Well, gee, Ken, we knew we were just kind of waiting for you to share it with us." Yeah. It was no surprise. And then too, you talk about no coincidences. The same way the Phoenix House was a block away from me, it turns out that there was a gay meeting just about a block in the other direction that I was able to start going to and to have that connection as well. But it's important for me that, you know, I got sober just going to meetings, you know, and yeah, there's different kinds of meetings, and some of them happen to be gay meetings, and I like to go to those too when they're available to me. But what's important for me is to make a meeting, because what I have in common with everybody is that I'm an alcoholic. You know, and also that you folks were here for me, you know, and the least I can do, what I need to do, it's not the least I can do, it's what I need to do, is I need to be there for you. And I started doing service in different capacities because I was compelled to do it by the people at my home group in New York. And then when I moved on and lived in the number of the places that I've lived, you know, I was able to do things like become a GSR as well, you know, and learn more about how AA works. And I also had the opportunity to go to New York City to the World Services office, and as somebody shared in the other meeting, they do have one heck of a view. We have one heck of a view because that's our offices, and they treat you like that when you go, if you've ever been there to visit. I mean, I walked in, and the gentleman behind the counter, you know, he immediately stopped what he was doing, and I got to meet every one of the GSOs that were working that day, and I happened to be there on a Friday when they have a Friday morning meeting. Which apparently is what used to happen when Bill Wilson was around as well. And to be able to be a part of all that is a gift. It's just another one of those gifts in the program. And that's something that I'm very thankful for. And, yeah, to share, as I come to the conclusion part, to share some of the other gifts that have happened, and I share this, it's not to say, oh, gee, look what's happened for me. It's to share what can happen for each and every one of us, you know, within reason. Because anything that we desire can happen for us within reason, you know, if we work for it and we stay open for it and we reach a hand out. Because I heard these things. These are the things I heard from other people when I went, you know, when I was going to my first meetings in New York City. And yeah, I was able to go back to school and to get a graduate degree. I was able to make a career change to work in higher ed, which is something that I had desired to do, and that's something that I currently do now. I was able to be there for my mom's death last November, and to be able to help in all the ways that I could, even though I was, you know, 1,000 miles away, I did all the things that I could do, and fortunately my brother and his family were right there as well. I was able to be at her side when she died. On a lighter note is that, you know, I work in producing events, and one of the events that I had yet to produce was a funeral, and I got to produce my first funeral last fall, and apparently I did such a good job since then. I got a call from my dad. My parents have been divorced since I was very young, and I'm now the executor on his will, and just before I came, I got a call from my older brother, and I'm now the executor on his will, and I said, well, you know, it's, you never know what you're going to get. but one of the things that also that I've been able to do is that I've been able to find a higher power, and that's something that I didn't know that I was looking for when I came in. I learned after the first time I shared my story that I had a spiritual awakening. I didn't know that till other people had told me that. I also didn't know I was at a spiritual bottom when I came in. I wasn't aware of that at all. And I'm a slow learner. That's another thing that I've learned in AA. You know, and I've always considered myself to be bright and to be sharp and to be quick. But you know, it's really okay for me. As a matter of fact, it feels good to be able to say that I'm a slow learner. Because what I've learned is the things that I need to learn, for me, take a long time to learn. You know, I look around in the world that I live in today, and I see outside the rooms that there's a lot of people, you know, that don't that aren't even looking for the things that I'm looking for, and I believe other folks in AA are looking for, and that's a real gift. And another gift that I had was that I was back in the little room in New York. I get to go to a conference in New York City each year, so I get to go back to my old home group, and my first sponsor is still there. We get to go out to breakfast on Saturday morning the same way we used to when I first came in. And what happened this last time was that the speaker didn't show. And the gentleman who was chairing the meeting, he didn't know me, and he just happened to choose me to be the speaker at the meeting that morning. And there were like five other people who were in the room that were there when I had come into the room. And that was a real gift, because I was able to do what I had seen and heard other people do when I first came into the program. You know, and that's part of that. Our primary purpose, you know, is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. You know, it's for me to show up. You know, it's for me to get up in the morning and to say my prayers. You know, it's to have breakfast. It's to go do my job, you know, and to be kind to other people. Now, I'm in a position of being a supervisor, so I really get an opportunity, as I think all of us do in whatever our capacity is, to practice these principles in all of my affairs. And I found, as I've been sober for a while, when I do that, my job actually gets easier. And the most recent lesson that I've just learned, and it's something that I've heard over and over, and I could talk about it and actually make it sound like I actually believed it, and that is that I'm powerless. You know? And that's been a real awakening for me. How powerless I really am, you know, and that's in everything, you know, and that I really do need to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God. Otherwise, my life's miserable, you know. It's whenever I take my will back, that's when I get into trouble, and I'm like Velcro with my will. I don't like to let that go. And one of the other things I wanted to share is that I've had a desire. And because I've moved quite a bit in the last couple of years, I haven't had the opportunity, but I hope to now, to do some service going into jails, going into prisons. And you know, I just read an article in the New York Times in the last couple of weeks, and it was a story about the prison outside of Chicago with the success that they're having as a rehab. You know, but when I heard the numbers, the statistics that are there of how many people that are in prison are there because of alcohol, I mean, I almost fell over, you know. But what I have been able to do, even with moving around, is to have correspondence. You know, you can have correspondence with folks in correctional institutions through GSO in New York. And I just got myself a new pen pal. And I just got a letter from him just before I left to come here. And I don't think he's going to mind, and I'm just going to read a couple of sentences out of it, because this, to me, really is a good way to close it. And to bring home what our primary purpose really is. And he says, I'm scared of getting out because of my old lifestyle. I'm afraid I'll go back to doing drugs and drinking again when I get out. I don't want to go back to that kind of lifestyle. So tell me, if you don't mind, how did you stay sober? How did you get away from that? Where did you learn or hear about AA? Is your life better now, or is it worse now, since you have stayed sober for so many years? You know, I've always dreamed of a life with a good family and no drugs and no alcohol. But I don't know if that will happen or not. I'm going to need a lot of help on staying sober when I get out, and that is why I'm seeking advice now. Well, it's about shower time, so I'll close for now. Feel free to write and send whatever material you can to me. I'm just now starting on the first few steps. God bless you. And God bless all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kenny. That was great. Well, powerful ending. I forgot to mention, and I apologize, but somehow I don't think it was on here. If it was, I missed it. To please silence your cell phones and pagers, if you would be so kind, if you haven't done so already. And that will help our speakers not be interrupted. I loved what Kenny was saying about all of the stuff that was up at his home group to remind him of his primary purpose. My home group is a Cornerstone group in Dallas, Texas, and we had emblazoned on a black wall in white letters the Responsibility Declaration when the doors opened to that group. And the building was torn down a couple of years ago, and we had to move, and the trusted servants cut it out and framed it and moved it so it would survive in its initial form over to the new building. It was really rather cool, so our newcomers can always know what the group stands for, and that's rather nice. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce to you Nancy Kay from Maryland. Is that next one?
I'm a talk with my hands kind of person, and I can see that water just flying. And I need to breathe. Good afternoon. I am an alcoholic. My name's Nancy. And my home group is the Elk Ridge Monday Night Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And oddly enough, we meet in Elk Ridge, Maryland on Monday nights. And I'm privileged and honored to serve in that home group as its institution representative, and they allow me that privilege of bringing meetings into the institutions in the Baltimore area once a month. And the other privilege and honor that I get is I currently serve as the Maryland Area 29 Delegate to the General Service Conference, and for that I'll be truly grateful. And I take notes because I believe, I know for me, a thought's going to come in my mind. It's going to be like a man or a bus. I'm going to grab a hold of it, and it's not going to let go, and I'm not going to share with you anything about our primary purpose. I got to take my shoes off to keep me from shaking off of them. And I want to also tell you that this is an honor for me. I have no idea how I got here. I just have no clue. I got this letter in the mail and almost fell off my chair. My sobriety date is July 4th, 1988. Welcome to my party. So this is indeed a pleasure for me, and I'm shocked. I did take notes. I'm going to share with you. This is from my heart. I know some people don't like things prepared, but like I said, I need my people in my area know I'm a crier, and I need to keep focused. And when I got this, I sat down, and I did a lot of praying, and I did a lot of reading, and I'll read to you what I wrote and share with you from my heart along the way. And the first thing that came to my mind when I heard the topic of primary purpose is the forward to the third edition. And it says, in spite of the great increase in size and span of this fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another, sharing experience, strength, and hope. This experience is learned from me through daily living and through constant reading of our 12 steps and 12 traditions. And then when I thought about that, two traditions came to mind when I think about primary purpose, and it's our third tradition and our fifth tradition. Everybody hopefully knows that tradition five is each group has but one primary purpose to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And the first sentence in the 12 and 12 starts out, shoemaker, stick to thy last. Better do one thing supremely well than many things badly. The very life of our fellowship requires the preservation of this principle. Our third tradition states that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the long form goes on to say, our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse no one who wishes to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend on money or conformity. Any two alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided they have no other affiliation. And our primary purpose is defined within the pages of our fifth tradition, and it simply states that it's to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. In the beginning of our fellowship, I saw many of the same problems that we see here today. AA Comes of Age talks about the fear that drove groups in the beginning to establish rules for membership. They wanted to be sure that nothing but pure alcoholics entered the rooms. undesirables such as criminals, prisoners, beggars, tramps, drug addicts, and fallen women would not be allowed in the fellowship for fear they would tarnish or somehow destroy AA. If these rules have been enforced, I can't help but to speculate how many of us would be sitting in this room today. If those rules had survived, I know me as a criminal, a beggar, a tramp, and definitely a fallen woman, I wouldn't be standing before you today. Our early members learned through their experience that regardless of what path an individual took to get to AA, they could not refuse any person from entering and becoming a member if they had the desire to stop drinking. The same holds true today. Our experience has taught us that we must refuse no one. If we do, we may have signed that person's death sentence. I was 25 when I arrived at AA at my first meeting. I was scared and a broken shell of a person that experienced more than I'd ever wanted to. The path that brought me to AA was filled with broken promises, broken hearts, broken homes, and a broken spirit. I was searching for any place that would relieve me what I know today to be the bondage of myself. Up until I found AA, booze relieved that bondage, and I repeatedly found solace in a bottle. When I arrived in AA, I had no desire to stop drinking. I stand here before you today as a direct result of my mother's desire that I stop drinking. Had it not been for her desire, I honestly don't know where I would be today. And my mom died July 13, 1997. And for that woman, I'll be forever grateful because she introduced me to you. I continue to be very grateful that her desire got me to the doors of AA, and the desire to stop drinking, which eventually manifested itself in my own heart, keeps me here. As a newcomer in this fellowship, I had no understanding of our traditions and introduced myself like I heard everybody else. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm an alcoholic. I'm dual addicted. I'm an alcoholic and I'm cross addicted. I honestly didn't know anything about what dual addicted or cross addicted was. I just thought it sounded cool. And I just wanted to be a part of. I wanted so desperately to be a part of you. Thank goodness AA's had the knowledge and understanding of our traditions as well as the love for this fellowship and shared with me the importance of Tradition 5 and what it meant. They asked me why I introduced myself as an alcoholic and something else. They tried to explain that by doing this, I was setting myself apart from the rest of the members in the room. I thought they were jealous because they couldn't sound cool like me. No offense, because I'm there now. I considered them hard-nosed AAs and thought that if they weren't so old and had actually experienced a little bit of life, that they just might understand where I was coming from. I cussed them under my breath and went along my merry way, disregarding the comments and thinking they just didn't understand and they had to have been teetotaling lightweights. After I began to put some days of sobriety together and began to actually get sober, I could begin to read to comprehend. Of course, I read the big book and finally began working the steps with the sponsor. And not long into my journey, I began to participate in service functions in my area. And I got to tell you, I didn't do it for any other motive except for a guy. I'm married to him today. We'll be together 17 years in October, and he's in the audience. I used to laugh and joke when I met him. I had 3 months. He had 5 years. He was God's will for me. I didn't know anything about anonymity, so I didn't think I was allowed to share his name in a meeting, so I just referred to him as God's will for me and honey wonderful. And today, to the depths of my soul, I know he is God's will for me. So I love him dearly. But it was at those service functions that I began to hear and learn about those tradition things. They sounded like they actually had meetings, so I thought I should investigate. I obtained a 12 and 12 and began to understand what those people were trying to tell me. It made sense to me what they were talking about in the story in the 12 and 12 about the man who approached the old timer about joining the group, and even though he had other addictions, were stigmatized in alcoholism. After they consulted with the other groups, you know, the story goes on to say, what would the master do, you know? The man went to work on the steps of AA and to pass on the message of recovery from alcoholism to others. And once I understood this concept, I was no longer an apple and a banana. I was an alcoholic and nothing more. My journey hasn't been for very long, and I still consider myself fairly new in the fellowship. However, I have seen this issue come up over and over again. Like the early members, fear has taken hold, and there are those who believe we're falling prey to issues that will destroy this magnificent fellowship. Issues like drug addicts, court systems, treatment centers, prescription medications, and mental illnesses. I can only wonder if people with these other issues are really the same as our early members faced with the undesirables, criminals, prisoners, beggars, tramps, and fallen women. Do we have the right to judge them and prevent them from coming to our meetings, or worse yet, asking them to leave when they arrive? I can share with you at one of the first meetings that I went to, there was a gentleman sharing the meeting, and I was in my first 30 days, and I can tell you at the end of my drinking, I had a bottle in my hand and a needle in my arm. And the gentleman that was sharing was talking about doing drugs, and somebody after the meeting told him that he didn't belong here. And I'm so grateful that I found out that I belong here. Isn't the bottom line that we must refuse no one? Our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. I go to meetings and I see alcoholics suffering debilitating diseases other than alcoholism. And there's nothing but compassion from other AAs. I wonder how many of us in the room turned our minds off and rolled our eyes in disgust to the guy or gal who shared about the problems that they were having with medication they're taking for a mental illness, yet we swarmed over the person who shared about the problems they were having with chemotherapy or for treatment of lung cancer. These may seem very extreme examples, but are they really? Why are we so quick to scorn the individual with the medication problem and not the one with the chemotherapy problem? Both are problems other than alcoholism. Both divert us from our primary purpose. The pamphlet, Problems Other Than Alcoholism, makes clear that sobriety, which is freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of the AA group. Bill Wilson goes on to say, AA members who are so inclined should be very encouraged to band together in groups to deal with sedative and drug problems, but they ought to refrain from calling themselves AA groups. There seems to be no reason why several AAs can't join if they wish with a group of straight addicts to solve the alcohol and drug problem together. But obviously, such a dual-purpose group should not insist that they be called an AA group, nor should it use the name of AA in its title. At the General Service Conference last April, the theme was Our Primary Purpose, the Cornerstone of AA. We had several workshops and heard several presentations surrounding the topic. What I took away from that experience was that I couldn't continue to live in fear of AA being destroyed by individuals coming to AA with problems other than alcoholism. What I can do, what I am responsible for, is to continue to educate those in my home group, in my district, and in my area, that we have a fellowship that turns away no one. However, all we have to offer is recovery from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body known as alcoholism. I also have another responsibility to educate those in the professional fields that interact with AA, what we can and what we can't do. I need to take time to educate those who may not know that Tradition 3 defines who we are, and Tradition 5 describes what we do. Simply stated, we're a bunch of drunks who have a desire to stop drinking, and our purpose is to carry the message of recovery from alcoholism to those who wish to recover. We are a fellowship of men and women who share experience, strength, and hope with each other so that we may solve our common problem. The common problem is to help others recover from alcoholism. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That means sobriety and nothing else. In AA tradition, how it developed, Bill Wilson warned us, AA's unity will not preserve itself. We are responsible to do that. In AA Comes of Age, Bill wrote, and I quote, the 12 traditions also point straight at the many of our individual defects. By implication, they ask each of us to lay aside our pride and resentment. They ask for personal as well as group sacrifice. As members of a fellowship, we all have a responsibility to open our arms to all who enter. However, the responsibility does not allow members to say and do nothing, to do anything. How we introduce ourselves and what we share from the podium or around the tables does matter. It mattered in the beginning of AA, it matters today, and it matters to those yet to join us. Upholding our traditions is not always a popular thing to do. It can be uncomfortable and difficult. However, looking at the alternatives, I'd rather be uncomfortable than be drunk. Bill Wilson envisions... Bill Wilson envisioned what he called one world of AA guided by the language of the heart. He believed that this would protect AA from any outside influence. In Warren T. 6, he adds, it is probable that we AAs possess no greater freedom than any fellowship in the world today. We know that we personally have to choose to uphold AA's 12 steps and 12 traditions or else face dissolution and death, both as individuals and as groups. Currently, I sponsor a woman born with one leg, another with a mental illness, a woman battling cancer, an anorexic, and a whole bunch of alcoholics. The common theme in all of them is that they all have a desire to stop drinking. One-on-one, we discuss issues in their life. I personally have no experience with mental illness, cancer, anorexia, or loss of a limb. However, as these are real challenges in each of these ladies' lives, I cannot very well sponsor them without the topics coming up. None of them bring these issues up in an AA meeting. But again, they are everyday issues that they face, and they'll lead each one of them to a drink. So too are the issues of drug addiction, sex, gambling, and the like. Although they're separate issues from our third traditions, individuals suffering these other challenges and issues who have a desire to stop drinking are welcome in our fellowship. I can reach my hand out and help them recover from alcoholism through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One-on-one through sponsorship, we can help these individuals not take a drink one day at a time while facing chemotherapy, mental illness, gambling, or any other life-altering event. That's our job. Help those who have a desire to stop drinking. Help them not take a drink no matter what comes down the pike. The key, I believe, is to focus on the solution and not the problem. I believe we should all be inclusive and not exclusive. But with that comes responsibility to share with each other that the only thing we have to offer is recovery from alcoholism and nothing else. I'm not sure about any of you, but I can share with you that I go to a dentist to get a cavity filled. I hire a plumber to fix a leaky toilet, and I go to a mechanic to get my oil changed. And this simple philosophy can be applied to AA. Through love, tolerance, and sponsorship, I can try to help others understand that I don't go to a mechanic to get a cavity filled. I don't hire a dentist to fix my leaky toilet, and a plumber doesn't change the oil in my car. If you have a desire to stop drinking, I can help you. However, the only experience I can share is recovery from alcoholism. The only thing I can offer you is sobriety. If you have problems other than alcoholism, we'll work together to find you the help that you need outside of AA. My job will be to get you through whatever you face one day at a time without a drink. And Bill said it better than I ever could in a 1948 Grapevine article, and I quote, "We shall never be at our best except when we hew only to the primary spiritual aim of AA, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers alcoholism, because it has now become plain enough that only a recovered alcoholic can do much for a sick alcoholic. A tremendous responsibility has descended upon us all, an obligation so great that it amounts to a scared trust. For to our kind, those who suffer from alcoholism, recovery is a matter of life or death. So the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous cannot, it dare not ever be diverted from its primary purpose." That's the end of my written comment. Now, 5 minutes. And I got about 5 minutes, and I want to share with you just a little bit of my journey of how I ended up standing here today. I got here July 4th, 1988, and I started drinking at 10 years old, and I drank till I was 26 years old. And I was raised in a very wealthy family out in Colorado, so any of you from the Colorado area, I was raised in Pueblo, and I grew up in a 22-room house with a 3-acre yard, and I was given absolutely everything that life had to offer me. 10 years old, my parents went away to Hawaii, and I picked up my first drink of alcohol. And I don't know, it just did something to me. It made me complete. I always thought one day, I'm number 7 out of 8 kids, and I thought one day I'd wake up and my parents would tell me that I was adopted. That the true story is, nobody wanted you, Nancy. We felt pity for you and we took you in, and they haven't told me that yet. So I guess at age 43, I better stop waiting. But 17 years old, I found out I was pregnant and I didn't have a clue how it had happened. They don't kind of teach that stuff in Catholic school. And they do today, and me and my 15-year-old daughter talk about that stuff today, but me and my mom didn't talk about that stuff. And I told the guy that got me pregnant what had happened, and I gave him two choices, marry me or die. Because when my dad finds out, he's going to kill you. So I forged my birth certificate, made myself older than what I was, and got married and continued to live in my house. So I turned 18 years old, and he continued to live where he was going to live. And then we went off on my 18th birthday to do the house, the picket fence, 2.5 kids, happily ever after. And I know today that that's not what a marriage certificate brings. All he did was drink and fish, and all I did was drink and cry. I was 18 years old. I gave birth to a little girl, and I was a kid trying to raise a kid, and I didn't have a clue. You know, granted, my mom had given birth to eight of us. She might have a small idea on how to raise children. And I was too ashamed and too afraid to call my mom and ask her for help. Because what I thought I would hear was, I told you so. You made your bed, you lie in it. These are your choices, your decisions. And I was afraid to ask my mom for help. And that was to be the story of my life until I turned 26. When I finally picked up the phone one day, I'd moved from Maryland to Texas to Virginia and back again looking for it. And I don't know what it was. You know, that marriage didn't last, and I drug that poor little girl everywhere. June 16th, 1985, I had landed in South Jersey where I ended my drinking in a little place called Pine Hill. I was living in an apartment. I had no heat, no electricity, no hot water. The extent of my living skills were I knew how to get my welfare check and I knew how to get drunk. I had an eviction notice one more time, and I went to my next-door neighbors and I asked them if I could use their phone because I couldn't do this anymore. I was putting my 5-year-old daughter in an ice-cold tub. And she's saying, Mommy, Mommy, please, it's too cold. I don't want to do this again. And I'm trying to be a good mom. She needs to take a bath. You know, I'm not going to do that, but I know I need to get my daughter clean. And I went next door and I made a phone call, and I called that little girl's grandparents, not my mom, because, see, I can't call my mom. I can't tell her what a failure I am. I can't do any of this. So I made a phone call next door, and I asked the little girl's grandparents if they could come take her from me, and they said yes on one condition. I said, name it. I got 2 days to get out of here, and I got no place to go. They asked me to sign away all custodial rights to my daughter, and that's what I did. And from that day to the day I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I lived on the streets of Atlantic City and Philadelphia, and I did absolutely whatever I had to do on a daily basis to survive. And I can tell you, my parents didn't raise me to be like that. They gave me the best of everything, you know. My life was the Black Horse Pike, and I got a really funny story to tell you about the Black Horse Pike that just happened recently to me. But so that's what I did, and in August of 87, I got myself into one more predicament, and I got arrested. I can't even do that. I used to say, knock on wood, for the last time, but I just got arrested on May 31st on my birthday in New Jersey. But I don't like New Jersey, but that's okay. That's on my four-step list. But I got arrested, and I finally called my mom. And I hadn't really talked to my mom since I was 18 years old, and I was 25. And that's how I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. She bailed me out, and I skipped town. I did everything you weren't supposed to do. And I ended up in Columbia, Maryland, 85 pounds, dripping wet, with a T-shirt and a pair of blue jeans, and that's all I had left in the world. And I detoxed on my mom's couch for a couple weeks, and I was brought to you. I had a brother who had been a member of this fellowship for 3 years at the time, and my mother had a desire for me to stop drinking. She told me that I could live in her house if I attended this AA stuff, and I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and my journey began. And I started coming to you. I didn't get sober right away. It took me 11 months to get my first day sober, because I came to you in August of 87, and I got sober July 4th, 88. And I don't know, the journey's been absolutely amazing. You know, I got involved in service right away. I was 3 months sober. I was hauled to this convention on the back of a Harley by another girl I was living with, and she stuck me behind a coffee and soda bar, and I met God's will for me. He shares this, so I'm allowed to share it. The way he puts it is he went up there to go get involved, and he looked at the volunteer list, and he saw Tom, and he saw George, and he saw Fred, and he saw Nancy. He signed up to work with Nancy, not knowing who Nancy was or what Nancy looked like. He's not stupid. He had 5 years, and he was, well, he wasn't single, but he had 5 years. That's his stuff, not mine. I wasn't looking. I'm serving soda. I'm staying sober. We ended up talking, and we started dating, and we've been together ever since. He had 5 years. He was a group service representative at GSR, and then I started going to assemblies, and I just got hooked. I got hooked on AA, and I got hooked on the service work, and I'm absolutely willing to do whatever you ask me to do to stay sober today, because I'm not willing to give up my seat in here for nothing. I do not want to live the way I used to live. I'll sponsor any woman that asks me. I'll go to any service commitment. I'll go to any meeting. I'll do whatever you ask me to do. Just give me a job, please. I want to stay sober with all my heart and soul. I don't want to go back there. I was privileged to give birth to a little girl my second year of sobriety, and she's here with me today. I have the gift of being a mom. I thought I'd given up that right. That other little girl, when I went to go make amends to her, my amends to her is to stay out of her life because she doesn't want me in it, and that's okay. That is okay. I've been around here long enough to see that in God's time, not my watch, she might be back in my life, and I'm good with that. I've done everything I can. My side of the street is sparkly clean white. She's got to do what she's got to do. She's 25. The phone rang the day before Christmas. I hadn't heard from her in a couple of years. So I know she's out there. She's writing her story just like me, 25, three kids. Just doing a lot of drinking. You know, I need to save her a seat here. I want to tell you one quick story about getting arrested, and then I'm going to shut up. May 31st, I've done all my amends. My list is clean. I've turned myself into the state of New Jersey, 7 warrants, 1 year sober, all that stuff. I go to get my driver's license. I wake up on May 31st. I'm turning 43. I say my prayers. I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and then I go to Maryland DMV. And I go to get my driver's license, and the lady looks at me kind of funny because first I can't pass the vision exam. I'm like, okay, I can deal with that, and then she tells me she can't give me a license. And I'm like floored. Evidently, I have a warrant out for my arrest in the state of New Jersey that I didn't know about. A year sober, I had 7 warrants, and I went and turned myself in. So I called the sponsee who was unemployed, or old sponsee. She's now back with me. And I said, you want to go on a road trip? She's like, where? I'm like, well, evidently they got a warrant out for my arrest in New Jersey, and we need to go take care of this today. So on May 31st, I went and got arrested. And you know what? Thank God it happened. They wouldn't have let me across the border to come here. You know, God works in mysterious ways. So I drove illegally for 2 days back and forth to the state of New Jersey, and they let me through into Canada, so I'm happy. I don't know if they'll let me back, but... you know, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous today, and I love my life. And, you know, we do one thing here. We help drunks live lives that are absolutely amazing. Stick around, get active, get involved in service. It's the secret to happy sobriety. If you don't know the secret, it's service. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. That was a great talk. Not only is Nancy a great speaker, I will tell you, if you don't get a chance to come up and see her, she has the most spectacular fingernails I've seen at the convention, perhaps ever, not being a connoisseur of those things. But in any event... So it is time for us to close, and we have the choice of closing with the Lord's Prayer, the Serenity Prayer, or the Responsibility Declaration, and it is my choice. Oh, the power! And I think for a primary purpose meeting, if it is okay with you, I would like to close with the responsibility declaration, please. Can we all stand and do that, please? I am responsible.